Next, we have Jason Vargo, who is a scientist at the University of Wisconsin's Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, and he's also at the Global Health Institute. He has a background in urban environmental planning and public health. His focus is the impact of urban form and planning decisions on the environment and human health. He has had publications that cover topics such as the health effects of climate change in urban areas and the potential for mitigation of the heat island effect to save lives. So his presentation will be very appropriate to the topic. Go ahead, Jason. Maybe, Jason, you're on mute.
Got me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, I was just talking to myself there for about 10 seconds, but now I think I have all of you. Thank you for having me, Victoria, and thank you for attending this webinar, all the registrants and attendees. I'm going to be talking today about one study in more detail that we did while I was a PhD student at Georgia Tech, and this was conducted in the Urban Climate Lab at Georgia Tech. And then I'll talk a little bit about the new directions that research is going and hopefully think about how that helps guide local policy to mitigate the heat island and improve public health. So I think many of you are familiar with the sort of transect that is used to describe the heat island. I just presented here because I'll be using it to describe how we change the actual landscape. So when you see these different typologies like rural, suburban, urban, residential on the bottom, they have different sort of heights, they have different densities, they have different ways that they reduce the naturally occurring vegetation. And so we'll be thinking a bit about what policies actually do to the landscape, and then thinking about how that impacts climate. As I said, most of this work came out of a study that was a three-year study funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and it was called COOL, the Climate, Urban Land Use, and Excess Mortality Study. And in that study, we looked at three metropolitan areas in particular, Atlanta, Philadelphia, and Phoenix. This study was led by Dr. Brian Stone at Georgia Tech School of City and Regional Planning and the Urban Climate Lab there. So there are a number of different ways that we can get from questions about different types of urbanization to the actual health impacts that are mitigated by climate. In our study, we chose to look at the land cover of urban areas, how that land cover impacts temperature, largely through the mechanisms that we've described when talking about the urban heat island. And then finally, what are the health impacts? So the health-climate relationship that we were interested in looking at, we could have looked at vector-borne diseases or ozone production. We chose to look at temperature and heat illness, and specifically we looked at mortality related to temperature. Much of this work appears in this article, which you can dive into a little deeper if you're interested. Now, here's the transect again, and I presented just to sort of talk about what we did with the land cover, so the urbanization part of that three-phase urbanization climate health model. We took the business as usual for these three metropolitan areas in the year 2050, and we began to think about what space do we have to play with, what building space do we have to play with, what public space do we have to play with, what private land do we have to play with. And through a number of different scenarios, we implemented policies. Some were related to particular green area ratios that were required on residential private lands or commercial private lands. Others mandated technologies like green roofs or surface whitening through high albedo coating. And so we made the urban landscape look something like what you see on the bottom, a variation of that. It could have been through tree planting or through albedo or a combination thereof. Now, in practice, these would look something like this. in our models, it's just a fraction of vegetation, a fraction of concrete, a fraction of high albedo concrete. But in practice, it actually looks like this. You take a dark asphalt parking lot, sort of move it underground, perhaps cover it with high reflectivity pavement, add some trees, and we think about what that does to the actual temperature in an urban area. Or take a streetscape that's denuded of vegetation and begin to add trees. We were looking at future metropolitan scenarios in the year 2050, so we presumed that we could plant these trees now, and in the next 35 years, we would have some substantial canopy from those investments. Now, to get to the last part about the heat-health relationship, we looked at heat and health in two different ways. The first way that public health scientists understand the heat-health relationship is through looking at summer temperatures. And we know that temperature and the mortality rate are related, so that higher temperatures, we see higher mortality. And this might look something like this, where you see a dotted line like summer temperatures fluctuating over the course of several months, and the number of deaths also fluctuating. But we also wanted to look at sort of the extreme event. This is data from France and Paris, and you can see that during the 2003 event, the huge spikes in temperature that were prolonged but also much higher than normal caused very, very large spikes in mortality. So we wanted to capture this too. So it's not just the elevation of summer temperatures on average, it's also the occurrence of these extreme events that Victoria already mentioned. Now, to do that, we used a couple of different health studies that have been referred to in the epidemiological literature as capturing this relationship between temperature and mortality, excess mortality. You can see that one of the studies uses mean daily apparent temperature, and another one uses minimum daily temperature. So we wanted to get an idea about the impact on health of maybe these different temperature metrics, particularly since the urban heat island is so important to influencing minimum temperatures as those nighttime temperatures. And then additionally, we looked at this study, which quantified a percentage increase in the baseline mortality incidence for every heat wave day that a metropolitan area experienced. So we could add on the impact of we could add together the impact of elevated summer temperatures on average and the occurrence of these heat wave days. Now, these are some of the results, and before I begin to talk about what we found, let me just describe what I'm showing you. Each bar is a different scenario, so if you see something like road albedo, that means in Atlanta, in this case, we changed the albedo of all the roads, or building albedo, we made the building surfaces, the roofs, higher albedo than were measured in the business as usual. And then all albedo combined them. Private greening was vegetation added on private land through the green area ratio policy that I mentioned, where we required 50% of commercial properties and 80% of residential properties to be vegetated. If they didn't meet that standard under the business as usual scenario, we forced that. And then public greening, look at public land and adding trees to parkland and vacant lands like that. All greening is obviously those two combined. And then all strategies sort of combined the greening and the albedo. That's the blue bar. And when you compare that against the elevated mortality that's expected in the year 2050 as compared to 2010 because of warming over those 40 years, we found that all of the strategies implemented over the Atlanta metropolitan area could offset almost that increase we see in death. So to say that another way, if you looked at Atlanta today or in 2010 and you thought about what the temperatures might look like in 2050, you might experience about 55 more deaths a year from higher temperatures. That's a combination of the heat waves and elevated summer temperatures. And when we implemented all the strategies, we found that we could offset just over 50 deaths a year for the Atlanta metropolitan area. So that would allow Atlanta to sort of cope with the impact of global climate change by taking local actions that can protect health. In Phoenix, the numbers were not as comparable between the warming out to 2050 and the impact of all strategies. But importantly, this analysis allowed us to sort of look at the health benefits of different types of scenarios. As you can imagine, in Phoenix, greening scenarios are much more water-intensive and expensive. And so they might not be as feasible. But it's important to realize that through the all-albedo strategy, Phoenix can get almost the same benefit as albedo and green combined, that blue bar at the bottom. So it makes sense. It doesn't make sense for Phoenix to go out and invest in water-intensive strategies like planting a lot of new vegetation, but they can really accomplish sort of the same local cooling health benefits by using reflective coatings solely. And that, I think, is an important finding for policymakers there. The analysis allowed us to look down at census tract level, begin to think about which census tracts are benefiting more and less in each urban area. This is what, for example, it looked like in Atlanta when we combined the average summer temperature reduction and the reduction in the number of heat waves. We see in most cases between 0 and 2 deaths avoided for all census tracts. The next thing that we started to look at was who's really benefiting from these strategies. We sort of implemented these in a blanket way, where we said we want this green area ratio policy to be applied to the whole of Atlanta, and then we want to see what the health impacts are. When we began to look at sort of which census tracts were winning more and losing more, it was very interesting to compare cities like Atlanta to Phoenix. In Atlanta, you see that the average avoided mortality rate, which is basically how effective the strategies were in reducing deaths for these people, it was very effective for the poorest people in Atlanta. That's a very strategic investment for reducing the health risk to the people who are the most vulnerable or have the least adaptive capacity to sort of deal with the health threat. In Phoenix, that trend was sort of reversed, where we saw these urban heat island mitigation strategies really benefiting the tracts where the median income was over $75,000. And it sort of had this reverse effect, where it wasn't benefiting the people who needed the most. When we looked at race, again, you can see Atlanta and Phoenix sort of on this opposite end. In Atlanta, these strategies benefited majority non-white census tracts more than majority white census tracts. And in Phoenix, it was the opposite. And in large part, that has to do with the existing spatial patterns of income, race, and we looked at age as well. But the way that those patterns exist in the two areas. In Phoenix, for example, you see the highest percent impervious in the urban core. The same in Philadelphia and Atlanta. The difference is that in Atlanta, we have a lot of impervious surface in the urban core. That's where you see the strategies having the greatest impact, lowering the temperature the most. But that's where the majority non-white census tracts are in Atlanta, and but not so much in Phoenix. So the existing spatial patterns of income and age impact sort of the environmental justice implications of these strategies when they're applied regionally. So let me just quickly talk about a couple of the new directions that we're going. On this graph, you can sort of see a hypothetical situation where we looked at three different temperature health relationships. Medina Ramon and Zanobetti are two that we used in that cool study that I mentioned already. So as temperature increased, we saw sort of a linear increase in the excess mortality. But we know from better epidemiology that really temperature health relationships follow a U-shaped curve. So above, and this is represented by a curve like the Gasparini 2015. These are colleagues at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine who have produced these curves for more than 400 cities around the world. And so they compare mortality to a an ideal temperature where mortality is the lowest it is. And below that temperature, you have cold-related deaths. Above that temperature, you have heat-related deaths. So we're getting much better at sort of approximating the relative risk of exposures at very high temperatures, which you can see on the Gasparini. Once you get up to 32 or 33 C for a metro area, the percentage increase in daily mortality that we can estimate with the new Gasparini function is much different and more accurate than we were previously doing with Medina Ramon or Zanabetti. So the epidemiology is really improving, and we're trying to use that to quantify the health impacts of these strategies. Another thing we're doing is beginning to look at very specific urban design level and using satellite imagery. So in this case, we're looking at a neighborhood in Chicago on a very hot day. We see the land surface temperatures in the neighborhood on the left about 7 degrees warmer than the neighborhood on the right. Now, that's land surface temperature, not air temperature. But one interesting thing that we've begun to investigate, but we haven't gotten really in deep to yet, is the number of buildings and sort of the design principle about putting garages behind houses. On the hot neighborhood block, you see 39 houses and 71 buildings. 36% of the block is occupied by footprint. On the other side, you see almost the same number of houses, 35, but far fewer buildings. That's because many of these houses don't have detached garages the way that the neighborhood on the left does. And in that block, only about 22% of the block is occupied by building footprint. You can see much more tree canopy behind the homes. So that's an indication of maybe a local, very local urban design level policy that might be maintaining existing vegetation and really helping to lower temperatures. Next, in Madison, we're lucky enough to have some ambitious PhD students like Jason Schatz, who shared this with me, to set up and maintain a network of air temperature monitoring sensors around the Madison area. We have over 150 sensors that have been maintained for 3 summers now, or 3 years. Every 15 minutes, they record temperature and humidity. This is what they look like. And I will say, because I know there are a lot of government agencies and officials listening, that some of the most important work that goes into this project is negotiating the contracts for permission to put these up and maintain them. So that's really hard work, and anything that can be done to sort of make that easier will really help the surveillance of the urban heat island in your area. Also, good relationships with the researchers at the university who are doing that work is very important. What we've begun to do is sort of create surfaces for different months or days or summers and look at how those overlap with local level hospital admission data. What we found in preliminary research is that the zip code variation in temperature doesn't help explain a lot of the hospital admissions. Rather, the ambient sort of metropolitan level measurements of temperature that we already know are increasing and related to indicative of these extreme heat events are really the strongest indicators of the health impact. So what that suggests to us is that while we're going to continue to sort of examine the local level differential in the heat island and what impacts that might have on natural systems like these lakes that you see in Madison, really to start preparing for health impacts of heat island, you don't need to wait for better information about the zip code level temperature or how different one part of the city is from another. We know that the urban heat island mitigation strategies can be implemented now, lower temperatures and save lives. All of our research is trying to go toward improving the data that goes into quantifying the benefits of heat island mitigation. This is a work from the Royal Society in the UK in a report that I recommend you check out called Resilience to Extreme Weather. They rate these different sort of strategies on their affordability, but also effectiveness, and give you an idea about the strength of the evidence and the overall positive or negative consequences. One thing that public health officials are talking about a lot is especially with vegetation strategies in urban heat island areas, is the selection of species so as not to increase the amount of allergy-producing pollen and exacerbate asthma conditions in the city. So that would be an example of maybe a negative co-benefit or a disbenefit, I've heard it called. It seems here that they haven't really captured that yet, but it's interesting to begin to think about sort of how your city maybe is taking on these different strategies and who these strategies might work best for. Obviously, the most effective is the most expensive air conditioning, so that's an important consideration to go into these policies when you think about the social impacts of mitigating heat waves. So just to wrap up with some of the conclusions, the countermeasures that we saw in these metro areas effectively reduced temperatures, and they reduced it to a degree that where we could see the health benefit. So these countermeasures were found to offset half to almost the whole of increases in heat-related mortality that are expected in 2050 from global climate change. We keep pushing to quantify the health benefits more accurately, but there's ample evidence already to support your local action. And that we're going to hear a lot about that from Pierre next. Finally, to really make the convincing argument, especially to private partners, I believe, and also to in the public sector, the health benefits of urban heat island mitigation need to be combined with the other benefits. It's very encouraging to see the results of the poll and the, between the presentations to see that people are interested in the quality of life benefits of the urban heat island, thinking about representing those in combination with the health benefits, in combination with the environmental benefits and the energy savings, and et cetera. So creating those more holistic representations of what the actual benefits of these vegetation or albedo strategies are is really an important piece of seeing the work done in place. Last thing I'll mention is just that if you're interested in climate change and health, there are a couple of upcoming resources that I would point your attention to from the University of Wisconsin. The first is an online, open, free course that lasts for 4 weeks. You can find it at this web address, Climate Change Policy and Public Health. It's led by the director of the Global Health Institute, Dr. Jonathan Pack, and he's also the co-editor of a new book that was released this summer called Climate Change and Public Health. It's intended to be an accessible textbook for a number of different fields and disciplines. And I recommend that you check it out. It's available on Amazon.com. With that, I'll just say thank you, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you, Jason. I think your research is really important, an important contribution to the field. And I think it helps public policymakers do the work that they need to do. So keep doing that good work. We're going to turn back to Wendy for the next audience participation question.
Great. So the next poll question is on your screen now. And the question is, which of the following strategies is your community interested in integrating into infrastructure planning? Trees and vegetation, green roofs, cool pavements, or none of the above? And for this question, you can select more than one response, and we look forward to seeing your answers. So again, I'm just going to give everybody a few seconds to provide your responses. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share the results. And it looks like 91% of participants said they were interested in trees and vegetation, the clear winner. 53% mentioned cool roofs, and then 44% said green roofs, and 44% said cool pavements. Only 3% said none of the above. And with that, I'll pass it back to Victoria, and once again, just remind everyone to please send in your questions to speakers through the questions pane.
Thanks, Wendy. Again, the answers to the poll questions are really helpful to us. For me, it's not surprising that trees and vegetation are number one. But the other ones, I can see people are interested in those as well to a significant amount. So that's great.